Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether or not the US and Russia, let alone the Syrian parties themselves, will be able to come to an agreement over peace talks on Syria. Former White House Middle East advisor Ambassador Mark Ginsburg joins us to discuss Russia's insistence that Iran join the international conference and remarks from Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov cautioning against arbitrary deadlines, implying Secretary of State John Kerry is getting ahead of himself. Then we look into today's annulment by Guatemala's highest court of the verdict of genocide against General Rios Montt, who was sentenced to 80 years for the deaths of 1,700 of the 200,000 Mayan Indians murdered by the Guatemalan military. Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College and author of The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala, joins us to discuss her recent article at the New York Times, "We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It." Then finally, we'll speak with Lee Shepard, a contributing editor of Tax Notes, who was recently named one of the Global Tax 50 most influential players in international taxation by the International Tax Review. We'll discuss today's hearings before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, where the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, was grilled over avoiding $9 billion in taxes in 2012 and keeping billions of Apple's profits in Irish subsidiaries to avoid paying U.S. taxes. And joining us now is Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, a special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs, and he serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg.
It's quite a mouthful, thank you.
It is indeed. And the current Secretary of State, John Kerry, seems to have his hands full at the moment. I believe on Wednesday he meets in Jordan to try and shore up the Syrian opposition, or at least to find people that will talk to the Assads, assuming that the Russians can join the Assads. And now the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is warning the United States against setting arbitrary deadlines for an international conference, which they appear to have agreed to. So what do you think is happening here in terms of the possibility of even having peace talks about Syria?
I think it's hard to decipher what exactly the Russians have in mind here. When the secretary went to the Middle East and then ultimately met with Foreign Minister Lavrov, he had already gotten a pretty good indication how much the Russians were willing to buy into this idea of a conference and whether or not they could compel anybody to attend. Part of the deal here is that I think the personal collegiality between Secretary Kerry and Mr. Lavrov is well understood. What is less well understood is how much do the Americans understand how far the Russians are willing to go in compelling Assad to attend a conference where the preconditions are everyone agreeing that he's not going to be forced from power anytime soon.
Well, but that assumes that the Russians can influence Assad, and that's not entirely clear, is it? Or how much
no,
they
it
can.
Isn't. I mean, at this point in time, the battle, the situation on the battlefield is shifting dramatically to his favor, and the bare knuckled terrorism that Hezbollah and Iranian Revolutionary Guards are bringing against the Syrian opposition military forces is already self-evident by the battles that are taking place and the retreating that is taking place as a result. I mean, we're talking about ruthless 8th century type of indiscriminate fighting that is taking place.
Well, and also, you know, on the other side, we're hearing from Hezbollah themselves, and there's been an unprecedented number of funerals in Lebanon as a result of this fighting, that the Hezbollah fighters are saying that the rebels fight to the bitter end. Even after you shoot them, they still come at you. So both sides are absolutely involved in absolutely taking no quarter.
Well, this is a battle. This is what we call a duel to the death.
So
the fact is that you have right now not the moderate what I would call what's being lost here is not that you have a battle between moderate, secular, well-trained, Western-oriented military forces who are controlling the battlefield. You've got the radical Shiite terrorist organizations of Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran fighting the Al-Qaeda-leaning terrorist-designated al-Nusra Front. And these two, this is the scorpion and the mongoose in a bottle.
Well, what about this notion that I'd heard from a journalist in Lebanon who has written a book about Hezbollah, and he said that I don't know whether this is what people are thinking in Lebanon or in the region, but he suggested that, you might recall Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, Henry Kissinger's famous remark about the Iran-Iraq war, it's a pity that both sides can't lose. Is there a sense that these murderous people are going at it and we're just going to sort of sit back and let them do it until they get exhausted?
Well, if you were to ask me what is the Obama administration's policy, I'd say you just put the nail on the head, hit the nail on the head. The hand-wringing that is going on around the world over the escalating humanitarian catastrophe belies the fact that in the end, other than funneling arms to this, that, or the other group and communications equipment and what have you, what passes as a policy at this point in time is essentially asking the Russians to deliver Assad to the more secular opposition, and they ain't going to do that.
So we won't even get to having the fig leaf of a peace talk, is that?
No, I'm not saying we won't.
Right.
I'm saying that you haven't even reached the table yet. This is going to be hearkening back to the days of the negotiations in Paris between Henry Kissinger and the famous Vietnamese negotiator.
Lee Duc Tho.
Lee Duc Tho, where they spent weeks, if not months, arguing over the shape of the table and who was going to be sitting there. I mean, the Russians insist, for example, that Iran be at the table. The Americans and the other Arab states do not. Well, is there going to be an Iranian representative there, and are they going to come up with some nice little finessing diplomatic compromise to designate that Iranian representative as an observer? I mean, who knows? But this is what we're at right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, a former presidential advisor and U.S. ambassador to Morocco, who serves as special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. Well, this is sounding more like, to me, Ambassador Ginsburg, that's the personal relationship that John Kerry has with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, that has led to the announcement of a peace talks. But they're a long way. No wonder Lavrov is saying that we shouldn't put artificial deadlines. This is worse than herding cats, right? You not only do neither side agree on who should be at the table, the two people that you're trying to bring to the table won't even talk to each other, and it's not likely they will.
I think it's important for Secretary Kerry and his staff, who I have great affection and admiration for, to be very careful about making statements to the public, presupposing situations and acts on the facts on the ground, notwithstanding the best of intentions. And this has happened not just in the Secretary's initial forays into obtaining support for a peace conference on Syria, but has also occurred in his statements that have emerged from his meetings in Palestine and Israel. Unbridled enthusiasm is something that we respect and admire in the Secretary, but there's a point in time where his credibility is going to be placed at the test when he comes out and announces that this is going to occur, and then the Russians turn around and say, hold it now, that's not on the script. It leaves the Secretary exposed.
So in other words, he should not be too quick to express his wishes and hopes, but only go public when there's a concrete deal.
Well, exactly. I mean, in the end, I think, as I said, this secretary's new at the job, and he's a former senator, and there's a lot of consequences to the statements that he's making, and I want them to get it right. I really want the team to get it right. I don't want them to be placed in a position where American credibility, which is already completely vanished in among Syrians. I mean, if we are creating some sort of illusion here that by making these statements and by meeting with the Russians, we're going to curry favor back with the Syrians who are absolutely disgusted with American policy, forget it. It ain't going to happen.
Well, but one of the things that I find extraordinary about the situation, Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, is the duplicity of our Saudi so-called friends who are funding the Salafists, which are essentially the real fighting force, from what I understand, is the al-Nusra people, the hardline people that are getting the Saudi arms. We're not giving much to the secular opposition. They've been marginalized. What's Saudi Arabia want there? Do they want an al-Qaeda on the Mediterranean?
Well, that's a very good question, Ian, because it's not merely the reports of the Saudis that are doing this, but our allies who hosted peace conferences in their host country, the Qataris, who are doing the same. If anything, I suspect the Qataris are far more diabolical in funneling arms to the al-Nusra front than the Saudis have been. Although it's hard to sit back here in Washington and quantify this, and don't take it from me. I'm merely reporting back to you what I'm reading in the Arab media and from listening to my colleagues in the Pentagon. I think the best way to describe it is there's no Arab country that has clean hands in providing arms to the anti-Assad forces now.
Well, on the other side, the Russians, we know the Iranians are doubling down. Hezbollah's in there fighting for this key town that it looks like it's going to fall, and it looks like a major reversal in favor of the Assads. The Russians, my understanding is that 1 in 5 industrial jobs in Russia are in the arms industry, and they've sold billions to Syria, and they're doubling down too. They're threatening to bring in these anti-ship missiles, which are probably aimed at the Israeli Navy. So just Lavrov aside, what do you think's going on with Putin? Is he really that cynical that he's really more interested in selling arms?
Absolutely. Putin is absolutely cynical when it comes to Syria. Syria has traditionally been one of the major arms purchasers from Russia. In fact, I would put it in the top 5 countries that have purchased arms from Russia and has provided its oil revenue back for these arms purchases. So that's point one. Point two, the Russians have a geostrategic military stake in the Assad regime because they have their largest Mediterranean naval base in Syria in a town called Tartus, just near Latakia, Latakia in Arabic. And not only that, the Russians have always been a traditional ally of the Assads. And let's not forget, Mr. Putin is looking at his doorstep in the Southern Caucasus, and he sees a bunch of Sunni terrorist fighters fighting for succession against Russia. And we already had a little bit of this taste from Boston at the Marathon attack, where the place is overrun. Dagestan is Dagestan is the most dangerous country in Europe. And what Putin fears is that if Syria falls into the hands of al-Qaeda, al-Nusra organizations and becomes a Sunni terrorist state, it only makes his life more miserable in terms of Russia's efforts to quell these Muslim disturbances on the southern border. So why shouldn't we view Putin's interest as any more than, not that I'm any fan of his, but he's doing precisely what I'd be doing if I were him.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, how can you not be sympathetic to his position? So just in closing, is there anything that can be done? Is there a deal anywhere that can be made, particularly between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, I think in the end, the question is, can the Russians be pretty confident that in that a Sunni terrorist mob would not overrun and rule Syria. And if you can convince them of that, I'm sure the discussions are on the table. I think from their perspective, if they can keep Assad in power through some political transition that doesn't cause the Shiites to lose power, they're in favor of it. Mm. But other than that, I would be hard-pressed to be convinced myself that Putin is going to make nice with the Americans just because Mr. Lavrov has a nice relationship with Secretary Kerry.
Well, Ambassador Ginsburg, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Mark Ginsburg, who's a former presidential advisor and United States ambassador to Morocco. He served as a legislative assistant to Senator Edward Kennedy, special assistant to the Secretary of State, deputy senior advisor to the President for Middle East Policy, and a special U.S. coordinator for Mediterranean Trade, Investment, and Security Affairs. He serves as a special advisor to the Department of Defense Special Operations Command and an advisor to the United States Department of State on outreach initiatives to the Muslim world. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the annulment of the genocide verdict in Guatemala. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, At War with the Past, and the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. Her latest article at the New York Times is We Enable Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anita Isaacs.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And today the Guatemalan top court annulled the genocide conviction of the General Rios Montt, and it looks like they're going to sort of, apparently the ruling does not annul the entire trial, but everything that happened after April the 19th, which of course are the closing arguments and the conviction, that all has to be retried. Is this some kind of ruse on the part of conservatives on the court to delay and perhaps deny justice?
Yes, it most definitely is, but it's not. They are not acting independently. They are acting under tremendous pressure from conservative sectors within Guatemalan society who refuse to acknowledge the verdict.
So this just gets back to this malignant oligarchy that runs the country. People that you have written about, in fact, Anita Isaacs, in your recent article in the New York Times, you mentioned that a member of the oligarchy wants to ask you in relation to this issue over genocide of the Mayans, quoting the oligarch, why do you ask why Indians were killed? A better question is, why didn't we kill more Indians?
Yes.
That's a mindset amongst the elite?
Yes, it is. That was an extreme statement, but it's not a statement that was confined to just one member of the oligarchy. It's a statement that in various iterations I've heard repeatedly over the years. So it's a quote from one, but it's representative of the views of a sector of Guatemalan society that retains considerable, that used to have a monopoly on power, and that retains considerable power today. But its grip on power is gradually slipping. And so their reaction to the trial and the verdict, you know, is an expression of their fear and their shame and their guilt about what it means to convict the general of crimes of genocide.
Well, apparently the oligarchy is also in bed with the drug lords. Isn't Guatemala considered a narco state? I've talked to a number of officials in various neighboring countries, and they have, off the record, told me that it's a narco state.
Yes, sectors of the oligarchy are in alliance with the narcos. I'm not sure that that's the sector that's been acting now. Mm-hmm. This, what we're seeing now, is more of a reaction of the formal and most traditional sectors of the oligarchy, sectors who were deeply involved in the brutality and the genocide of the 1980s, sectors of society who enlisted the military to carry out the brutal repression, sectors of the oligarchy who have been profoundly racist from the beginning and who allowed a brutal repression to transform itself into genocide, sectors of the oligarchy who care in their own way about Guatemala's international prestige, and sectors of the oligarchy who have always controlled the levers of political power. So the organized crime, yes, there are sectors of the elite that are in close contact, that collaborate with organized criminal networks. But I'm not sure that's the most distinguishing feature of those, or the motivating feature of those who are so resistant to and determined to overturn the verdict.
Again, I'm speaking with Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College, and the author of the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. Her latest article at the New York Times is We Enable Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. And I guess from my understanding, from what you've written in the New York Times, Anita Isaacs, is that this oligarchical elite is paranoid and always has been, because of the majority of the population of Guatemala are Mayan Indians. And that sort of drives this extraordinary compulsion to want to murder the majority of your own population.
Yes, you're right. If we cycle forward, though, to today and what motivates them and why they're so opposed to it, I think that, you know, I'd say that there are three or four reasons that occur to me immediately. One is the fear. Well, one is something that they openly express, which is the concern that the image of Guatemala is going to be tarnished if Guatemala is recognized as a state, as a place where genocide was committed, that Guatemala is going to join the ranks, they tell me, of countries like Nazi Germany, or regimes like Nazi Germany, or the Rwanda, or Bosnia, or Cambodia. And they, for some reason in their mind, do not see themselves as in that same league. So there's a kind of embarrassment about passing their country on and having overseen a moment in their country's history where the state has been declared genocidal. So it's something that just they cannot tolerate.
Let me just get my head around this, Anita. You're saying that the Guatemalan elite, the oligarchs, they're not apologetic about the murder of 200,000 Mayan Indians. They're only concerned of the image of the country?
That's right. I mean, there's some other things that they're concerned about, but they're not apologetic. They don't acknowledge it. There are continued feelings of racism that are expressed through those feelings, of course. But yes, you've got it right. What they're worried about is not what happened. It's not shame about what happened. It's shame about how the country is going to be viewed by the international community and by their children, the kind of world or country that their children are going to inherit. That's part of it. I mean, they're also afraid. They're afraid because they're afraid of the implications. What does it mean to recognize what happened to Guatemalan's indigenous Mayan peoples? What does it mean that a court actually finds in their favor? It means that these people have rights, that these people are full citizens. And if these people are full citizens, well, you know, there's a fear because they're not like us. They're primitive. on the one hand, so they shouldn't be full citizens. And on the other hand, they're also frightened because what does this mean in terms of the revenge that these people might seek, the lands that these people might claim, and the kind of impact that might have on our interests? So that's the second and third dimensions. And all of this is wrapped up in a situation where the elite is actually, these traditional elite that has historically controlled power in Guatemala, is gradually losing its grip. Power is slowly falling out of their hands. And the majority of society and is becoming more powerful. The playing field, the political playing field is becoming more level. And that is tremendously frightening to them.
And Anita Isaacs, your recent article in the New York Times, "We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It." What I'm hearing from you and what I get from the article here is that we, in effect, enabled the elite as well. If you go back, as you do in your article, to the 1950s, to 1953, when the CIA conducted a coup against the Social Democratic President Jacobo Arbenz, quote, the U.S. ambassador there at the time as saying, and he was toppled because he was alleged to be a communist and was going to receive a shipment of arms from Czechoslovakia that may well have been a sting. The U.S. ambassador at the time in Guatemala, John Purifoy, he said famously, "I am definitely convinced if the president is not a communist, he will certainly do until someone comes along."
And yeah.
He will certainly do until one comes along.
That's
so
right.
There you have the cynicism that they put. They got rid of this social democrat, probably more to do with the United Fruits Company's land than the idea that the Soviets were meddling in our back door. But didn't that basically entrench the oligarchs and military rule?
Absolutely. There are a couple of things that were consequences of that. But yes, I mean, the oligarchy was also extremely worried, or as worried as the United States, and there were family connections between the State Department and the United Fruit Company, which also helped with the Alan Foster Dulles and John Foster Dulles were in both the State Department and the United Fruit Company. And so there were family connections that precipitated some of the U.S. involvement. But the oligarchy, the traditional landed elite, was as concerned for the same reasons as United Fruit Company was concerned about the possible nationalization or expropriation of lands as a result of land reform that was being contemplated and then was enacted. So, yes, the U.S. and the oligarchy saw eye to eye, if you want to put it in a, if you want to see it that way, in the 1950s. And the oligarchy collaborated actively with the United States and with the coup. They lent landing strips on their landed estates for planes to land. I have oligarchs who've told me in great detail about the whole operation. They even flew some planes. So they were actively involved in the coup. They were, the alliance that took power after the coup, the very reactionary alliance that basically turned back the clock and precipitated the rise of an insurgent revolutionary movement, was an alliance that had three legs to the stool. One of them was the United States, the other one was the oligarchy, and the third was the military. You know, I think that, you know, the Arbenz story is a very sad one, and it's sort of had enormous consequences for the continent in the course of history, because it was the failure, it was the toppling of Arbenz that, in fact, in many ways provoked the Cuban Revolution. Che Guevara was in Guatemala at the time of the Arbenz coup, and later went to Cuba and understood that you couldn't bring about reform peacefully, but that if you wanted to make reform in what the U.S. viewed as its backyard, you needed to stage a violent and armed uprising.
And of course, in a curious way, I guess, that is echoed in what happened in Iran with the toppling of another social democrat.
At much the same time.
Right. So Anita Isaacs, again, professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College and the author of the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. She also has an article at the New York Times recently, We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. Back to the overturning of the trial or the annulment of the verdict, and then they have to retry it after repeating everything that happened after April the 19th, the closing arguments, and then the conviction. What are the chances then of this reaching the same verdict?
That's a really good question. It's also a really good question. You know, there are a lot of legal questions. It's important to understand that this wasn't a legal decision. This was a political decision. So the legality and the legal ins and outs are very opaque and hard to understand, even for lawyers who've been watching this trial. So a lot of it is too complicated to figure out what the implications are for now, both by observers and even for those who are participants in it. But, for example, how does a different tribunal start rehearing a trial in the middle? What is there? Which judge? It will depend on which judge is appointed, or which three-judge panel is appointed to hear the trial. Clearly, it seems to be impossible for the same judge to just go back and rehear from April 19th. The date seems somewhat random to me. Actually, why April 19th? It's not at all clear. I was actually in Guatemala at the trial during those days, and there were a series of events, but it's not entirely clear why the trial needs to be restarted then. So the legal implications of it are, because this was not a decision that was really founded in law and jurisprudence, but was a result of political pressure, make it impossible to really understand or forecast what's going to happen. I think the next few days, next 4 days or so, this week, will probably tell us, you know, the direction that things are going to take. But I think that the chance of getting the trial back on track, and revisiting the closing arguments and having any chance of reaching a similar verdict, which for me is very much grounded in law. I think that the prosecution made a very strong case. Will in part depend on international pressure.
Well, let's touch on that just in closing then, Anita Isaacs. If the Guatemalan elite, the oligarchs, are concerned about the image of their country, what kind of impression could President Obama make if he weighed in, or if some high official here like the Secretary of State weighed in on and laid down a marker here in terms of justice and the historic and, you know, truth and reconciliation, but more importantly, justice?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the U.S. has potentially a lot of influence at the moment. It has a lot of influence, or it always has more influence in Central America, actually, than it does in other parts of the world. And the contrast is, I think, quite significant in contrast to the Middle East, which are where the U.S. has also done more than its share of meddling over the years. So, for starters, the United States has influence in the region. It's limited to some degree, but it does have it is able to put pressure, and I think that it can put pressure on the government to a certain extent. Because, not so much because of the trial or anything to do with the trial necessarily or only, but because Guatemala has a strong interest in other topics that are being discussed, other policy issues that are on the agenda, whether it's drug policy or even more so at the moment, immigration reform. So Guatemala has an interest in getting special consideration as these policies are discussed, policy reform is discussed in Washington. So that's one area where I think the U.S. has quite a bit of leverage. I also think that the United States has leverage with the economic elites. I think that the United States has the pressure of most of these, a lot of these people have houses in the United States. I've met many of them who, you know, have houses in Miami. And their kind of sense or concern, even that if people are, can be found to have tampered and to have sort of put political pressure on, to have bribed judges, et cetera, even threatening to withdraw their visas from the United States would be a possible option.
Well, Anita Isaacs, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me again.
Again, I've been speaking with Anita Isaacs. She's a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, At War with the Past, and the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. Her latest article in the New York Times is We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Senate hearings today, revealing how little tax Apple pays on their billions in profits. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Lee Shepard, a contributing editor of Tax Notes, a Washington-based weekly tax journal, one of the most widely read and respected tax commentators in the world. She has been a mainstay of Tax Analyst publication for 30 years and was recently named one of the Global Tax 50 most influential players in international taxation by International Tax Review. Shepard specializes in financial issues and taxation of multinational corporations and writes about cutting-edge financial issues such as derivatives, hybrid securities, hedge funds, and banking questions. She has appeared on 60 Minutes and Frontline, as well as in the documentary We're Not Broke. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee Shepard.
Thank you.
And today the Senate grilled the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook. This was the Senate panel chaired by Senator Carl Levin, the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, where we were told that Apple is holding overseas some $102 billion of its $145 billion in cash in an Irish subsidiary that earned $22 billion in 2011 and paid only $11 million in taxes. So what's your takeaway from what's going on the Hill today?
Well, you know, you have to step back and say, well, what does the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations do? Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations looks at things and finds things, finds all kinds of things wrong with the system, finds a lot of things wrong with the tax system, and it does that to communicate to not just the broader public, but also to the other Senate committees, namely the ones that write the tax law. And the ones that write the tax law seem to be content to have the tax law interpreted so that Apple doesn't have to pay tax anywhere in the world on its foreign sales. And so you got to sort of keep that in mind when you're looking at this. I mean, you know, I've been looking at this stuff all afternoon. We figured out that, yes, Apple can take a position that some of these subsidiaries in Ireland don't have to pay tax anywhere, which sounds crazy, but that's the way our laws are written and Irish laws are written.
Well, in terms of U.S. laws, though, Senator Carl Levin said in 2012 alone, Apple avoided paying $9 billion in U.S. taxes. And the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, said that, no, we handed over $6 billion in cash to the federal government. So
here's what they're both talking about. Apple says that it's got 40% of its worldwide revenue in the United States and 60% of its worldwide revenue in other countries, okay? And so Apple argues that, okay, the $6 billion that it paid in taxes to the United States represents basically sales of Apple hardware in the United States. And that the $9 billion, which is probably an estimate that Senator Levin is talking about, is foreign sales, and it is not immediately taxable in the United States. Now, there's a variety of rules that Apple is taking advantage of that Mr. Levin's report talks about and says these are not good rules and that they should be changed. You know, that is what Mr. Levin is talking about. He's really talking about changing the rules. It's not that what Apple did isn't pretty brazen. It's just that they have a colorable argument that it's within U.S. rules. Now, so other countries might disagree about, you know, their own rules for Apple's foreign income. But if we're talking about, does Apple have to pay tax to the United States on its foreign income, Apple has an argument that the rules let it do this, and Senator Levin has an argument that, you know, well, if they let you do that, they should be changed.
And, of course, his, the co-chair, the Republican Senator John McCain, in effect agreed that the company's tax strategy, he said, reflected a flawed tax system. So, again, I'm speaking with Lee Shepard, the contributing editor to Tax Notes. She specializes in financial issues of taxation of multinational corporations and has appeared on 60 Minutes and Frontline, as well as in the documentary We're Not Broke. One of the more bizarre exchanges in the hearings today before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations came from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who actually praised Apple and said the Congress shouldn't be beating up on them. They should be praising them as job creators. And, of course, then they talked a bit about the job creation issue. But my understanding is that Apple, if it's a job creator, it creates jobs in China.
There's job creators and there's job creators. And I think that Senator Paul and a lot of senators, frankly, are not thinking straight about what kind of jobs they want created and the level of jobs that can be created by a company like this. Now, if we compare Apple to, say, the old General Motors, okay, the old General Motors created hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs with good wages and pensions for people who were not hugely educated. Okay, these were sort of brawn jobs. Apple creates tens of thousands of jobs for people who are highly educated in the United States, and it's brawn jobs, if you will. It's jobs for people in manufacturing plants that are not as well paid and not as educated are in China. There are some of those jobs in the United States, but in a manufacturing plant in the United States, you can't be uneducated anymore. And so when senators think, and lots of legislators think this way because they're sort of trying to bring back the 50s, when they think, oh, well, if we bring back manufacturing and we're very indulgent to these companies, we don't make them pay any taxes, because there is actually a special manufacturing tax break in our law, that will recreate sort of the General Motors of the 50s. And the answer is that these guys should be asked to visit a manufacturing plant in the United States. And what they'll see is about an acre of robots and a few people who have at least a high school education, maybe not, maybe also some junior college, babysitting these robots. That's what a manufacturing job is in the United States right now. So it's kind of a pious hope that Apple is going to create, you know, hundreds of thousands of these jobs in the United States. It just is not going to happen, and these guys have got to sort of get with reality on that. You know, you can't say, well, we should excuse you from billions of dollars of tax, you know, depending on what our policy is, for you to create, you know, 50,000 jobs in the United States.
Well, but one of the guys that's saying this kind of stuff is President Barack Obama, who's proposed using the tax code to encourage companies to move jobs back to the United States. So is,
because people have noticed that the tax code is part of a variety of factors that encourage companies to move jobs out of the United States. They move jobs out of the United States for a whole slug of reasons, and it's not limited to the tax code, but the tax code is something that companies like to blame because they don't like to pay taxes, and congressmen like to blame it too because they have control over the tax code, and they don't have as much control over other things, or they have forsaken control over other things.
So what about, though, for example, American multinational corporations that earn money abroad? They simply don't pay taxes, right? That's the Apple situation. They only pay U.S. taxes. You say 40% of the income comes from the United States, 60% goes abroad. They don't appear to pay it abroad as well. So,
which is what's making the abroad angry at this moment.
So, and of course, in Europe, they're in a recession, and I'm sure the governments over there would like some revenues.
They would like some revenue. They basically look at the situation and they say, well, you know, if we thought the Apples of this world, because they're not the sole company that's doing stuff like this, the selling a lot of stuff, saying a lot of consumer product in Europe, visible to consumers, vulnerable to boycotts and things like that. They're not the only American company that's in that position. There are a lot of big American companies selling a lot of product in Europe, and they're not paying taxes to any of those market countries in Europe. And those countries, pretty much any country where you have a real market, have a lot of population, have a lot of purchasers, is going to have a real tax system, and the taxes are going to be high, and they're going to be higher than the United States in a lot of cases. So they see Apples and companies like that coming in, selling a lot of stuff, not paying tax in their countries. And this is a relatively recent phenomenon. This sort of happened in the last 20 years as these companies rearranged their structures the way you see in the Levin report, and as American tax rules changed to allow them to do stuff like this. Well, those governments are now saying to the United States government, look, you know, we wouldn't gripe about this if we thought you were taxing this income, but you're not. So we're gonna, unless you come up with a nice multilateral solution that says that these companies pay tax somewhere.
Well, Lee Shepard, again, contributing editor at Tax Notes. Isn't it true, though, that not only do big U.S. multinational corporations not pay taxes on their incomes abroad, don't they also hide a lot of their U.S. tax through various rubrics? For example, Pfizer, which makes Viagra, for example, they just put the formula for Viagra into their Swiss subsidiary, and all of the earnings on their top-selling drugs go to the Swiss subsidiary, which is just a shell, and they avoid taxes in the United States. Isn't that
yes.
how they
and
do it?
And United States law lets them do that. And United States treaties let them do that, and treaties all over Europe, because where's this money, where's this income coming from selling the drugs? It's coming from Europe. So it would be their worldwide income. Yeah, no, that is a fairly common setup. It's very common for drug companies. It does not happen to be Apple, but it is very common for other tech companies to have their intellectual property in a tax haven. And this is the kind of thing that the European governments and the United States government are arguing about right now.
Arguing, but not necessarily doing anything about it. Now,
well, this remains to be seen, because they argue slowly. And they're going to be arguing about this till July. And then in July, there's supposed to be an action plan to do something about this. But you have to sort of think about, you know, sort of geopolitically, you know, what's the United States' position in this? Does the United States want to make the Europeans happy, or does it want to make its own multinationals happy?
How about its own taxpayers? How about its own?
They're not an immediate concern. They're not uh-huh. the first level of concern of who we have to make happy.
Right. Well, that's because
now the United States government, the Treasury, is trying to argue to the multinationals that, you know, look, we have to do something to make the Europeans happy here.
Silly me for thinking that the United States government actually cared about the average American and not the powerful interests that give them money. Didn't they try a kind of tax amnesty and let some of these companies repatriate their money to the United States?
They repatriated a whole bunch of money, and then they paid it to their shareholders as dividends and to their executives as bonuses, and then they went back out to their international structures, like the things we've been discussing, and basically reloaded. And that's why, you know, you get companies like Apple saying, oh, we have hundreds of billions of dollars booked offshore. It's banked in New York. It's booked offshore, okay? Mm-hmm. And there are accounting rules that need to be changed that allow this. No, they're basically saying, you know, oh, look, you know, we didn't pay any tax anywhere on this money, so if we pay dividends to our shareholders back in the United States, we're going to have to pay 35% on that, and golly gosh, we don't want to do that. So you're just going to have to give us another amnesty, or you're going to have to go to a territorial system and give us sort of a permanent amnesty.
Well, the amnesty...
making that argument with a straight face right now.
Well, the last amnesty, they came back and they paid only 5%. So a lot of the Republicans, of course, are saying that the 35% corporate tax rate in the United States is driving business offshore and it's hurting America's competitiveness.
What's really happening here is the whole... It's not that there aren't sort of perverse incentives in the tax code and the accounting rules, because there's an accounting rule that drives this too, but... if these companies need to invest in the United States, they can do it. Okay? There's no blockade to an actual serious investment in the United States. The blockade that they're complaining about is a blockade to dividends. This is David Einhorn's argument with Apple. He's saying, look, you got all this cash, give some of it back to shareholders. He's not saying build 5 more plants in the United States. If Apple wants to build 5 more plants in the United States, there's ways to get the money back without paying tax on it to do it. There's no blockade to investment, so the Republicans are a little bit all wet when they're saying, oh, investment is being discouraged. Investment is not being discouraged, okay? It is dividends. This is just about dividends, this repatriation argument, the argument for a new holiday.
Well, I was going to say that the corporate tax rate may be nominally at 35%, but in practice, nobody pays that, do they?
Nobody pays it. Nobody pays it. You know, another sort of monkey wrench in the corporate tax argument is that when somebody pays it, the somebody who pays it tends to be a financial intermediary. And, you know, banks have a lot of power in this country, and they want the rate lower. I mean, what did the Europeans do when they lowered their rates? The Europeans basically made life more comfortable for their banks and less comfortable for their manufacturers because in order to get their rates down below 30%, they had to take away tax breaks that they gave to their manufacturers.
Well,
and, you know, this is sort of like what has played out in the United Kingdom since Margaret Thatcher. It's sort of banks versus manufacturers. Who do you want to take care of?
Well, didn't that happen here in the United States after the 2008 crash? Didn't we take care of the bankers?
We took care of the banks, and we're going to be paying for this for a lot of years. You know, having sort of having an oversized banking sector. But Europe, all of Europe has an oversized banking sector. The United Kingdom has an oversized banking sector. And that's why guys like Rand Paul run around wishing that manufacturing would be revived by some magic wand.
Right. But meanwhile, the financialization of our economy continues. So
and, you know, the only thing that's going to stop it is another meltdown.
So, Lee Shepard, just in closing then, what happened on the Hill today before the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation was just theater. They're posturing in order for the other Senate committees to do something. You said the Senate banking committees aren't going to do a damn thing. So,
The Finance Committee.
Finance Committee, right.
Yeah, the Finance Committee is the one that writes the tax laws.
And it's not going to move. So what's the takeaway for our audience here today?
Here's what happens with Senator Levin's committee. It is... When he you know, finds things and when they write reports, they start out as theater. And eventually people look at this and they think about it and they say, no, maybe we shouldn't be doing this, you know, and no, maybe we should change the law. I mean, years ago, Senator Levin had a hearing about how the big accounting firms were selling tax shelters on a wholesale basis, and something was done about this eventually. It takes a couple of years, but the other thing that's interesting here, and let's go back to our arguments that are going on at this moment between the United States and Europe about whether these big American companies are going to pay taxes to somebody, you know, be it the United States or be it Europe. There's a big audience for this in Europe. And, you know, even if people, not people, even if the powers that be in the United States say, oh, look, it's essential for our competitiveness that these things be allowed to go around the world and earn income and not pay tax on it in the United States, because there are people who feel that way, and there are a lot of them. The Europeans aren't going to put up with it. I mean, they're going to fold their arms and they say, see, you know, we don't like this sort of thing. All this, they're going to get angry with the United States. They're also going to get angry with Ireland for cutting deals with Apple. And they're going to say, see, you know, this is the kind of thing we were talking about. This is the kind of thing we don't like. So what are you going to do about it? And if you don't do something about it, we will do something about it. And the we will do something about it part gets the attention of the companies.
I see. Because well,
there's some kind of taxes they're willing to pay and other kinds of taxes that are really, really make them uncomfortable. And this sort of gets them back to the United States government complaining, and then somebody does something about it. But yeah, this is as far as that negotiation is concerned, this is a very interesting development. This is a very good development for people who eventually want these companies to pay taxes somewhere.
Well, that's encouraging, and I thank you for joining.
But it does take time. You got to be patient.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Lee Shepherd. And we're going to segue now to the film, We're Not Broke, which we're offering up here today in support of Background Briefing and of KPFK. The film, of course, you're in, along with Jim Henry and Ed Kleinbarton and all of the tax experts that we have in this country. So any final word on the film?
You know, what's fabulous about this, the Apple case, is, you know, Apple is discussed in the film.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that you see in the film is you see a small attempted consumer boycott of Apple.
Right. Well, that will certainly get their attention.
But this is, you know, this is an interesting final thought. I mean, I can tell you, you know, I could kill another hour of your time telling you about companies that are huge, that you have never heard of, that sell business to business only, that no consumer has ever heard of, and have not paid taxes to any government in the last 30 years. And no one cares. Okay.
Right. Except well, they don't know.
Those governments get a little excited, but you start talking about consumer products, you're talking about a whole different thing. You're talking about Starbucks in the United Kingdom offering to pay some tax to placate the government there because they were worried about consumers reacting.
Right.
That's something these companies need to think about.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Lee Shepherd.
Thank you.
Again, Lee Shepherd is a contributing editor at Tax Notes, a Washington-based weekly tax journal, one of the most widely read and respected tax commentators in the world. She has been a mainstay at Tax Analysts publications for 30 years and was recently named one of the Global Tax 50 most influential players in international taxation by the International Tax Review. Shepherd specializes in financial issues and taxation of multinational corporations and writes about cutting-edge financial issues such as derivatives, hybrid securities, hedge funds, and banking questions. She has appeared on 60 Minutes and Frontline, as well as in the documentary We're Not Broke. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.